Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's May 14th, 2021, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or you can always check me out at overthecap.com. We've got Nelly the Bunny here co-hosting. You got anything to say, Nelly? Once again, nothing, and I'm sure she'll jump in at some point later on with some interesting insights as she takes some drinks of water, makes noise, doing something. Who knows? You know, not too busy of a week, I guess, in the NFL this week. So we'll touch on a couple things here. No beer of the night again this week. Hopefully next week we'll be back to doing something, though. Again, I'm probably still going to be doing the light beer. So finish with the medication from the dental work, but did get the second vaccine shot this week. Did knock me for a bit of a loop. I will say that the first shot that I got, I didn't have any issues with it at all. Pretty much was fine moving forward. You know, it was, I don't really think I missed a beat. I got it at 1 o'clock, maybe a little drowsy for a little bit, but that might've just been me being tired. I was able to go out for a walk and was back to my usual routine the next day. This time around, I got the shot at the same time and I was perfectly fine. I was planning out my next day. I was like, all right, do I want to go to the gym in the morning, go in the afternoon? You know, how my day work out? What will I do? Blah, 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 blah. Well, I woke up at about 2 a.m. and just felt awful. And, you know, it just hit me that way. And I guess that's what happens. You know, some people are fine with it. Other people just get a bad reaction to it. So I have been kind of out of it for pretty much for close to 48 hours. So I'm kind of back to normal today, but I figured I would hold off on the beer drinking for a week. Still, just in case of anything. But I think I pretty much felt better. I may have compounded it by doing a leg day that morning. That might have made it worse. I guess I didn't really think about that, but maybe between that and whatever reaction to that, maybe that just made it even worse. But anyway, fully vaccinated now, so that's that is kind of cool. So hopefully that is you know, moving kind of behind us now, or at least you know, off to the side. It's the summertime. So I think last year all the stuff went down with the summer anyway. But I think in New Jersey, the rate is maybe around 40%. I don't know if that's 40% of adults, 40% of everyone. I would guess of adults because I don't think they're including kids in that since kids still really aren't eligible for it. But, you know, I think it's a good sign that things are kind of getting back to normal. We saw the teams are kind of jumping all over this that, you know, we'll be back next year, it sounds like. It's going to vary, of course, state by state, but it sounds like there's going to be a push to do full capacity. And, you know, you wait to see how things go. You know, it's obviously it's a long time before you see how things happen because there's other countries where they thought they were out of the woods and then, you know, people kind of got sick again. So hopefully that won't happen in September, October when the weather takes a different kind of turn. But, you know, hopefully this is kind of a return to normalcy. So I'll be excited if next year, I won't go to any games probably, but I'll be excited next year if we can travel to a couple things and, you know, get to meet a couple people again that, you know, listen to the podcast and work in the league and stuff or around the league, you know, just get to bump into some people and, you know, have a beer or two with them and just catch up. That's a little bit better than doing the Zoom conversations or, you know, random emails or Twitter conversations and whatnot. So, kind of cool, you know, to be getting there. So that was just my thing with that. So don't regret getting it one bit. But yeah, it did knock me for a loop. So if you can schedule it for a Friday, schedule it for a Friday. Don't schedule it for like a Tuesday. That would be my only little bit of advice, I think, in that regard. Slow NFL news week. I feel like this is the slowest NFL news week that we've had in some time. You know, we're not getting bombarded with Aaron Rodgers news. Basically all schedule release stuff, who cares? Now, if you're going to some of the games, yeah, that's kind of a big deal. If you're really interested in kind of your schedule for some of the stuff, like I don't like primetime games anymore. I kind of used to like them. I don't really care for them anymore because they're just too late by the time they get done. So, you know, Jets don't usually have too many of those, but you know, the primetime games, something I don't look forward to as much. But the one good thing with kind of being sick and being off the grid a bit for 2 days there was I didn't have to get too sucked into all the crazy stuff that comes with the schedule releases that come out. There's things you can look at with the schedules. You know, how many teams got stuck with back-to-backs, if you're playing teams off bye weeks, trips that you might have to take. There's a couple things to look at. But for the most part, they are what they are. And to see the schedules come out and people start doing the win-loss kind of games and all those different things, that's kind of silly. You have no idea. None of us really have that kind of idea just based on the schedule of how much those things change. You could have done that for the last couple of weeks and done the same exact thing over and over and over again. So, I think today, just to follow up on last week, and I think that's mainly what we'll do is just kind of follow up on a couple things from last week and then get into whatever questions that I got this week. But, following up on last week on the workout rant that I had, and I got a lot of feedback on that. I think a lot of people like that because I was I'm not happy with the player's position on this whole workout thing. So not surprisingly, Juwan James got released today. They did a post June 1 designation. I'm guessing they did that. I didn't even look to see where they're at with their salary cap space. That'll split him at 3-3 versus the full hit of 6. Because he's got the signing bonus money that's left over. I don't actually know. I'd have to look. I'm not sure if they have the ability to go after his signing bonus money still. They probably do. I think that's a little bit of a harder hill to climb once you release a player, even if you've released him for cause, which this is. That he caused that kind of injury. I'm going to guess the reason that they use the June 1, let me just take a look at the cap numbers for the Broncos. I still have them on the roster. I haven't processed the release yet. Haven't gotten around to it. I do have a very grumpy six-year-old, by the way. So there might be some grumpy talk going on upstairs at some point. Let's see. Where's the Broncos? Now, the Broncos do have plenty of cap space. They do have $20 million. Now, they did make some signings this week, so that'll go down 7. So they easily could have taken the 6. I'm going to guess the reason that you do that is in the event that James does file a grievance against the Denver Broncos, he's probably going to file a grievance not only for the $10 million this year, but also I believe he has a $5 million injury protection the following year. So he might file a $15 million grievance on there. And even though I think that grievance is kind of meritless, basically what's going to happen is that would cause a $6 million cap charge to hit the Broncos cap this year. So you would have the 6 plus the 6 and, that'd bring it to $12 million, which is almost where his cap number's at now. So you add that in with the contracts that they just did for Massey and Fleming and some of the other deals that they'll have coming in for the rookies. And that kind of brings your cap number down probably further than you really would like it. So I have a feeling that's probably the thought process maybe behind the June 1 versus just a straightforward release here because 6 million, 3 million, that really doesn't make a difference in the grand scheme of things. But if that 6 can turn to 12, that's a little bit higher. So, at that point, deferring that 3 million, I'm sorry, deferring that 6 million is a better deal. And I'm actually off on that. now that I look at the numbers here, it would have been 9 million if they did the regular cut, which is still okay on the 13, but if you add the 6 in on that, I forgot that his contract pushed a year because of the COVID. I was thinking that he just had the 2 years left, so he has the 3. So it would have been 9 million plus the potential for another 6 and a grievance. You'd be looking at a $15 million cap charge. So by doing it this way, they'll defer 6 and they'll take 3. So yeah, I guess I should have looked a little bit more at that before talking about it. But yeah, I forgot he was the opt out pushed everything. So anyway. I think there were some people that did have a little misperception on the contract language there. Just to bring it up, this is something that has been the case for many years. This is like not a new avenue of anything. I believe even in the Players Association's rebuttal to the NFL's assertion that they didn't have to, cover the injury, I don't even think the NFLPA argued that they had to cover it. I think they argued that teams usually would cover it. Let me see if that's the case. They sent an email. Let me just see if I can find a copy of what they put out there. The NFL, okay, here's what it says. We also discussed the NFL's memo relating to the injury suffered by one of our brothers this week. The NFL has never, ever sent such a memo about voluntary workouts, which is confirmation that your position is both right and effective. I have no idea what they mean by that. It was gutless to use a player's serious injury as a scare tactic to get you to come running back to these workouts. Okay, whatever. The memo is yet another sign of what they think of you and affirms that they simply want to control you year-round in any and every way that they can. This is such a bad job by the Players Association to be saying this to the players. We have been in touch with Juwan James. Despite the open threat of an NFI designation, Juwan was working out to stay in shape under a program recommended to him by his coach. And then that's followed up with clubs who care about their players have often in the past honored a player's contract for simply working out to stay in shape. So what the NFLPA is doing there is basically they're opening up two avenues to that they hope they can fight the grievance or that they can win a grievance. And the first one is that it's recommended to him by his coach. So they're going to try to say that the program was authorized by the coach. The second part of it is okay, yeah, they're within their rights if it's not authorized by the coach, but typically teams would handle this for you. So it basically is telling you that that's the case. But the part of the CBA in question here, it's appendix. You can find a copy in Appendix A of the collective bargaining agreement, which you can find on OTC, or you can just do a search for it. So the scope in question here, paragraph 3, other activities, without prior written consent of the club, player will not play football or engage in activities related to football otherwise than for the club. So let's just stop right there. Without prior written consent of the club, player will not play in football or engage in activities related to football otherwise than for club. So basically what they're telling you right there is that they need written permission. The player would need written permission, which is what we've spoken about, to train somewhere that, you know, is not affiliated with the NFL team. So they would have to put that in. So that's why they're saying the program was recommended by a coach. That's very different than something, you know, being signed off on. But at least that's what they're going to do. Second part of it is, or engage in any activity other than football, which may involve a significant risk of personal injury. That is a separate thing that you would look at. That's talking about other activities, you know, that might be related to football or whatever, not related to football. And if you want to throw weightlifting in there, that would have the same threat of injury as playing basketball. That would have the same threat of injury as doing anything. And most of these contracts, when you really get into the nitty gritty of stuff that's in there, you know, they try to cover every little thing possible to make sure you know what is and isn't considered, you know, dangerous. But, you know, when you look at this, basically the teams have a right to not allow you to do anything, you know, because if you get hurt, they're not going to cover it. And this has been something that's pretty much held up forever in the NFL. I'm sure it's been challenged before because we've seen players who have been released before with injury. Remember, it's not just the fact that there are guarantees on the contract. Any contract is guaranteed when a player gets hurt. So there's been plenty of players who have gotten hurt during your off-season programs or doing other stuff that might be related to rehab or whatever, and they haven't been able to collect their full salaries. Have teams taken care of them? Yeah. Would it have been the right thing for Denver to do? Probably so. But, you know, you take a tact like they've basically done, and this is what's going to happen. And, you know, from what I've kind of been told, you know, that I think there is, there's been too much pressure that's been put on by the association on the players to just have a walkout for really no good reason. And that's what happens. And now it's going to happen again in Denver because their wide receiver, he just suffered a torn ACL, again, practicing away from the facility. And again, I would imagine it's the same kind of situation. Now, they were going to trade him. Apparently, this is going to make a trade fall through. Well, obviously, it's going to make a trade fall through. But again, it's going to be another player who's going to be, you know, cut with no financial compensation and with a type of injury that's going to cost you to miss the season. Now, it's a real devastating blow for these two players, and hopefully it doesn't happen to anyone else. But, you know, this is a position, this is something that should have been taken last year. I don't know where these voices were last year that these workouts were so important to not exist that they needed to be gotten rid of. And it's just, again, you know, going back to it, it's just terrible. But, you know, these players here are unfortunate. They're unfortunately the, I don't know, in a sense, you probably look at them as like an innocent bystander. You know, it's you believe that this group has your best interest at heart. They're supposed to. And in this case, they really don't. You know, they're telling you, don't go. There's no reason to go. Teams shouldn't control you year round. And it's safer to be doing stuff on your own. But if something goes wrong when you do it on your own, you're not covered anymore. And we're not talking about little bits of money here. You're talking about lots and lots and lots of money. So, you know, I'm not just not crazy about the whole thing. But that was kind of some news today. The other thing was, you know, going back to the trades from last week that we kind of discussed a little bit, that also brought some debate. People get very passionate defending the picks their team makes. And that's perfectly fine. You know, the purpose of these, and I guess this is just what happens when it comes to trying to analyze certain picks or kind of go over the process of it. When you're evaluating a draft right now, what are you really evaluating? For the most part, you're evaluating the process that comes with the draft, whether that is looking at reaches, whether that's positional strength, whether that's grading trades. You're grading them based on history. You're grading them based on stuff like that. So I don't understand the argument that comes, and most of this has come because I've been very critical of the Jets trade. It has not come as much from the Dolphins, a little bit there, but not as much, which is a little surprising because I basically put the Dolphins had two awful trades in there, but a lot of it's come from the Jets, and I've hammered that one home because a lot of people, I think, have hammered that one home. But you can't say, and this isn't to single out any one person because I got this from a lot of people. You can't go out there and say you can't evaluate that trade until those players take the field. And then after that, you follow it up with Joe Douglas had a great draft. Admit it. It was awesome. He got the best players. Everyone's grading the Jets draft an A. So F you for saying it. You don't know football. Okay. I don't claim to know anything about the players themselves, but I can tell you a lot about the history of the stuff. But how are you telling me that I can't grade a trade, look at the probabilities of a trade succeeding without the player stepping foot on the field, and then tell me that without any player stepping foot on the field, that they hit a home run in the draft and it was great and they did it perfect? I mean, that's kind of nonsensical, isn't it? That's pretty hypocritical, I would think. You know, to bring those two arguments because they kind of conflict a little bit there. So that's not one I get at all. And the thing is, when you bring up these points with the trades, you're not saying no team should ever trade up. You know, I don't care if the Jets want to trade up, they want to trade up. My point is, if you look at it historically, you will basically come to the conclusion that with a trade like the Jets or a trade like the Dolphins made, you will probably look at that and say, okay, you know, if we go back and we evaluate this a couple years from now, probably about 20%, 25% of the time, they will outright win it. So in no way, shape, or form is anybody saying that picking the guard in that spot or picking a right tackle or taking the wide receiver, you know, giving up an extra first round pick to eventually pick a wide receiver, nobody is saying it has no chance of working out. You're just trying to quantify the amount of risk that that team took to take on that trade. And, you know, like I said, there's a 25% chance that it'll work out. So if the Jets strongly believe in that possibility, you know, good for them. Maybe this will be one of those, you know, 25%, you know, times that it really works out to where if you look at the type of player they could have gotten at 23, I think is where they were going to pick, and you look at the type of players they could have gotten in the third round versus who they end up with in the fourth round, and you kind of look at the type of players who were there. And when we evaluated trades in the book, you know, we did direct. So it wasn't even like, well, they could have gotten this guy, this guy, this guy. It was just purely this would have been 23. This would have been 66. This would have been whatever the Jets picks were. You know, and you would just trail it that way to come up with kind of who made out better. You know, you'll have situations as well where the player is not a bust. You know, he's a decent player, good enough player to where you probably don't care. You know, you don't go and look at those other players and say, well, this is what could have happened. You know, I think there's probably about a 40% chance that one of those two scenarios occurs. And then in the other 60% of the time, you probably look back at that and say, okay, what if? What if we did something a little bit different? So again, it's not saying that the trade can't work out. It's just saying that more often than not, you probably end up on the losing end of that. You know, and some of the stuff just goes haywire. So I saw a tweet from, I don't even remember who it was, where I guess because of a lot of the discussions on the trades, you see, I think the discussions on trading in the NFL have really gotten a little bit more nuanced now. They've gotten better. It's a lot stronger, I think, than before, with the way that you know, sometimes we looked at some of these trades. I think there's a little bit more numbers to it. I think there's more honest discussion about it. I think there's a better understanding, or at least more widespread openness to the fact that, yeah, there's positional strengths in the draft and positional weaknesses. There's different ways that you can build a team through the draft that are probably more efficient than others. And you kind of take that now all into account when we look at these trades. And, you know, I think the comment was something like, you know, analytics, the draft analytics now wants everyone to just have like 32 seventh round picks. And I don't know, the conversation's never gone anywhere, even close to that. The conversation is just about how hard it is, how much harder you might be making it on yourself when you make these leaps up for certain players. And you're just trying to come up with the amount of times that something might work. And when it doesn't work, how much it costs you beyond just a couple of picks, where someone will say, you know, so I made the mistake of saying a 3-for-1 trade on Twitter, which everyone jumps on. Well, they got a fourth. It's 3-for-2. Okay, whatever. You know, it's just putting something out there. I can tell you the analysis was always on a 3-for-2, you know, where you look at the differences between the 3 and the 4, but the third and the fourth round. You know, but for someone to say 32 seventh round picks, I mean, come on, nobody is saying that. The purpose is there is this feeling, and I don't understand why this exists, but it does in the NFL. It absolutely 100% does with most of the teams and everything else. One, there's this feeling that you can beat the draft. Nobody has really been able to beat the draft. You know, if you look historically, if you looked at the way that the picks typically work, the results of the picks, basically the more draft capital you have, the overall better you perform. Doesn't mean everyone's a hit, and a lot of times they're not, but a lot of stuff kind of balances out. So you the more dart throws you have in terms of effective area dart throws. Effective area dart throws are basically first round, second round, third round. You know, the better chance you typically have for success in the NFL in the draft. If there are teams that have beat the draft, who would they be? The Ravens, for a period of time, have probably beaten the draft. They've done better than their draft slotting on a somewhat of a consistent basis. The Rams have done actually pretty well, I think, in the draft. Not as well as the Ravens, but they've done decent in the draft. You know, and on the other side of things, it's really only two teams that have dramatically underperformed. The Browns, maybe that's changing now in the last couple of years, but certainly at the early part of the decade, you know, when I looked, I think back from, 2011 to 2016 or 17. I can't recall if I had 17 in there as well. I might have had 17 in there. I just can't recall. But they were way below where their draft slot was. Way, way, way below. Like to the point where it didn't even make sense. But, you know, that's just so much turnover and everything else just did a poor job. And the other one is the Jaguars, who haven't been bad. They just haven't been as good as you would expect, because basically what they've done is they've had a lot of top 10 picks, and they've got guys who aren't atrocious, but while some of them have been hits, like a Jalen Ramsey, others have been kind of so-so. I think on the scale when it comes there, but everyone else pretty much falls in a pretty consistent pattern. You know, and I think sometimes we get caught up in, okay, they're saying that this is worth a seventh round pick. And it's not that that's what's going to cost you. It's always going to cost you more to trade up. The point is, the jump from point A to point B within a round is very minuscule, all right? If you go and you break the draft down and you look for superstars, okay, there's about a 45% hit rate for superstars in the top 10 picks. Once you get outside of that range, and you know that's certainly not surefire, that's less than 50-50. You know, and once you get out of that range, there's not a big difference. You know, the rest of round one is maybe around 26-25%. You get to round two, it's like 22-23%. You know, round three is probably around 20%. Now, the bust rates go higher a lot of times. But if you actually break the draft down into like picks 20 to 32, you know, the playoff teams versus the non-playoff teams at the top of the second round, you find there's not a big difference there. So the probability that you're getting a much better player, the likelihood that you're getting a much better player, is basically the same as the likelihood that you're getting in the seventh round, which has about an 85%, you know, bust rate in terms of long-term probability of being in the NFL. You know, it's about the same percentile chance that you get a player who's a average player in the seventh round. You know, an average player in the seventh round is basically someone who would be barely worth more than the minimum salary in the NFL. And, you know, would probably be worth like $1.5 million, you know, somewhere in that ballpark. And you have about a 15% chance of getting one of those players. But you don't have any chance in the seventh round of basically hitting a home run. It's like a 0.7, I don't remember the number, 0.5% chance. It's a very low percentage chance that you hit a home run in the seventh round. The point of it is just to say, to get from 23 to 14 or 23 to 20 or whatever numbers you want to bring in there, you know, 43 to 40, you're improving your potential for a hit by a very, very, very tiny amount. And the potential for a hit in the third round, especially if you're taking multiple shots at it, is much higher. You know, if you have two third round picks, you basically have 75% chance, give or take a little bit, that at least one of those players is going to be productive. You know, he'll be a productive player for you for the next 4 years. If you change that to a 3 and a 4, those numbers go much lower. I don't know what the number is exactly off the top of my head, but it'll be lower. And, you know, you look at those things, and that's where you kind of come up with these high prices that are paid to move up. And, you know, it's very hard, I think, sometimes to exploit edges in the NFL. But that's all you can do right now. You know, it's like, you know, you go to Moneyball. You know, everybody talks about Moneyball in baseball. Moneyball was a thing until everybody kind of took on the basic things of Moneyball. And it became the Yankees doing, quote unquote, Moneyball. And basically what it was something that was finding the most efficient way to build a roster where you do have a lot more constraints than teams have in the NFL when it comes to money, to something that teams were just using to really identify who are the best players and what are the players that complement them, you know, each other better to make these teams that are much better baseball teams. So in the NFL, whatever the things are that teams are doing, you know, you get an edge right away, and then it's a copycat league, right? Everyone starts to copy it. You know, maybe sometimes they don't do a good job of copying it, but that's kind of what you do. So the areas that you can exploit right now, obviously there's some in-game decision making. You know, that's really a big focus, I think, right now of the analytics stuff. But I think if you look at the draft and you get into the concept of positional drafting and you get into the concept of the true value of a trade and how you can kind of take advantage of the system, so to speak, that exists for trading players, I think that's an edge that you can still exploit until more teams kind of get on board with that. I think that you can look at things when it comes to salary cap management more along the lines of contract structuring than probably, you know, how you're going to approach certain players. I think taking a more reasonable approach to free agency, where you take that realistic look at, okay, this is the odds this player is going to be effective for 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, instead of just always assuming, like we do with the draft, that the players are always going to be a hit, they're always going to be a home run. I think those are the kind of edges that teams aren't exploiting enough and that probably can be exploited more. But no one is saying you don't need first round players and you build a team with seventh round picks. And that's just silly. You know, nobody has said that. Nobody's talked about that. You know, those are just the ways that I think that you can do this. And I think they're the right kind of discussions that you should be having to, I think, advance the way that you build a roster, advance the way that you plan in the NFL, is by kind of talking these things out, talking these things through, and using all the data that exists from the past to try to model what you should do in the future. Doesn't mean you should never, ever, ever trade up. You know, there's instances where it probably makes sense. You know, but I think teams have this misperception about what they're going to find. You know, you treat a first round pick as if every first round pick in the world is going to be a franchise changer. And they're not. There's nothing that suggests that whatsoever. You know, quarterback maybe. Well, quarterback definitely if you get the right guy. Most of the other positions, not really. Maybe they change a narrative about a team. Maybe they help you in some way, shape, or form. You know, they certainly will help you in that you can find some players that when you look up in the stands, you know, a lot of people will have their jersey on. You know, that's an important thing for what you're building, keeping your job and stuff like that. You know, but they're not really franchise changers. And one of the things that was coming back a lot was, you know, this year, because everybody on Twitter knows everything, you know, everyone's in the conversations with the teams. I know I'm not, but everybody else is apparently. The Jets, for example, didn't value the third round picks because of COVID. And, you know, I have heard certain things, not as blunt as that, but basically that, you know, there were some concerns with the draft this year. And I think maybe that was the case with some of the trades that we saw, because again, every team is, I think, overconfident when it comes to the draft. Is there any team that gets their 7 picks, 8 picks, 6 picks, 5 picks, and goes out of that day after those 3 days are done with the draft and goes, man, we effed that up. God, we did a bad job. No, everybody thinks they hit a home run. Everyone thinks every pick is wonderful. Everyone thinks every pick is going to contribute and every high pick is going to be awesome. And I think it was Breer that mentioned in his column this week that, you know, a lot of people said the first round is only 15 picks deep. And that explained why the Jets really went up for the guard, was because he had a top 15 grade. And they knew if you go beyond 15 players, you really weren't getting a first round pick. Again, historically, you look at the numbers. There's not a big difference between 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 33, 34, 35. It's a very small decline. So it's never been the case. It's never like the first round has these magical, mythical players that are only available in the first round, and then you don't find anybody anywhere else. Like I said, if we go back and we look at those numbers, let me pull them up, at least from the time frames that we looked at, which I think was a 5 or 6 year time frame. Let me see if I still have them here in a handy way to look at them. So if we want to look at the hit rates, which is I'm going to find a tier one player. This is a top line NFL player. Not even getting into the position, just the overall numbers here. Let's just take a look. And what do we have? Nelly is pretty charged by this discussion, as you can hear. All right. So I mentioned the 45% or so hit rate is 44% top 10, 26%, 11 to 32, 21%, 33 to 64, and 8% in the 65 to 100 range. That's just defining an elite level player. So again, where we're looking at these drafts, round one, round two, there's no real difference between that. It's a very small difference to be giving up stuff to get there. You know, if you look at just really productive players, identical, 42%, 42%. If you look at the bust rates are actually higher in the round one than The bust rate is higher in the round two, the next level where you get those moderate players. And a lot of times the moderate players are because you got this first round grade that keeps you in the league. So guys keep getting chances and chances and chances. You know, but that's the kind of, increase that you expect. And when you go through the drafts historically and you look at the drafts, you will see that every draft at the end of the day is very similar in terms of overall production. Once in a blue moon, 2013 is really the only year where the first round was indeed really bad. Like the actual results that year were probably statistically, if you ran them, would be, you know, outside of the realm of normal probabilities. You wouldn't expect it to be as bad as it was that year in the first round. But when you bring in the whole draft, it ends up being pretty similar to the other ones. It's just at the top, the teams missed everywhere. But I do think that maybe because teams didn't have the time to go over 8 million things with the players and they weren't able to watch him in the combine, and they weren't able to, you know, interview 8,000 guys and have everyone seeing these people in person and all these situations all the time. You know, you weren't able to overanalyze, analysis by paralysis, whatever you want to call it. You weren't able to do all that stuff. So maybe teams were less confident in their ability to magically pinpoint those players later in the draft. Maybe that was the case. You know, and I think that's just a problem with the way that teams approach it, because the fact is nobody beats it. And if every year it turns out to be the same, the only reason this year would be any different is if COVID somehow kept players from entering the draft. So in all likelihood, you're going to have a lot of these same players every year that pop up in the second round and third rounds and turn into very productive NFL players, fourth round, whatever it may be, they're still going to be there. Maybe you didn't think they were there, but they're still going to be there. So, you know, I don't buy that argument. I shouldn't say that. I buy it from a team perspective that, yeah, I do think that there were teams that probably bought into that this year because they didn't feel like they had the confidence in their picks that they would have in a normal season. But all that confidence doesn't bring you anything. Never has, never will, unless you're the Ravens. I just don't see the purpose sometimes of just saying that, you know, it always makes sense because the team is always right and the top of the draft is always incredible. You know, the Lions apparently were going to trade up to draft their tackle and they called Atlanta. That would have been insane. Absolutely crazy. They were lucky Atlanta said no. Now, a lot of people said, well, why did Atlanta say no? Atlanta said no because I think Atlanta probably didn't evaluate much of the rest of the draft. I think they knew that they were going to draft the tight end. They knew he wasn't going to be there if they dropped down 3 or 4 spots. So they didn't want to do that because they didn't really have other options. But most of the time, you have multiple options for a pick. You know you have multiple options. And I bet if you evaluate those multiple options, some of those guys are going to end up being good, and some of them, maybe even the ones you picked, probably not so good. And that's what you should be evaluating as a team, is you should be evaluating your own draft boards. We don't get the ability to do that. You know, maybe I should try and do some of that stuff with Brad and work with Mike Renner and some of the guys at PFF to look at some of their draft boards over the last couple of years and see, you know, how some of their lower players have done. You know, in terms of doing well when it comes to play in the NFL. And those who maybe they weren't as bullish on, those they weren't as bullish on that ended up getting drafted highly, how those players did. You know, I think that'd be a interesting exercise to really go back and look at some of the pre-draft evaluation kind of stuff, grades or whatever you want to call it, and see how that performed, because that's how teams should be evaluating. You know, evaluate the players that you had there and see how those players worked out, and then go back to see, well, why didn't you pick those players? Or why did you not believe that this guy was worth it and this guy was worth trading up for? You know, those are all conversations that teams should be having. But the only way you're going to get ahead in the league is to find those ways to exploit those edges, exploit the things that you can do with the draft. And there's a lot you can exploit in the draft. You can exploit stuff that will help you with free agency. You can exploit stuff that will easily help you with your salary cap. It will help you in a lot of different ways if you do it the right way, or at least if you attempt it. I can't say it's 100% right. It's all theoretical, but someone's got to try it. Someone should do it. And when we talk about that stuff, that's all it is. It's about different ways that you can do stuff in the NFL, some of which might sound crazy, some of which might turn out to be crazy, some of which might turn out to be pretty right. So I think that's kind of, just a little of the feedback on it. You know, that there is this, and it's the one thing that I think is always going to kill when it comes to, as Troy Aikman likes to call it, the analytics in the NFL. Nothing is 100% right. And too often we look at these things as if it's always right and wrong when it's not. And maybe we don't do a good job of presenting it sometimes in a manner where you're saying, you know, there's a chance that it will work, and this is how good it would need to be to make it work. Maybe we don't do a good job with that. You know, we don't do a good job with when we talk about the, and I don't get into this stuff, but, you know, the fourth down decision making and that kind of stuff, when, you know, Florio goes on his rants about, you know, how it cost somebody a game or something like that. The problem is it's never going to work 100% of the time. You just need to be able to do things enough to where you get that edge to where something is working 60% of the time, 70% of the time, 65% of the time, when everyone else is, you know, doing the norm, which we know is only successful 35% of the time or 40% of the time. That's what you want to do. You're just looking to increase your hit rates, you know, but it can't be just a one and done. It has to be something that's kind of like a systematic approach to how you're going to do these things. Not just you take a shot here and that's that. You got to do it the whole game, you know, or you got to do it the whole offseason. You got to do it the whole draft. And again, you can vary, you know, time to time. That you have to sometimes vary. And sometimes, you know, maybe you don't make the decision that's going to be by the book. But, you know, maybe there has to be something that that we do a better job explaining that stuff. But, that was just some of the things on that. The other question that came up a lot had to do with the Dolphins and the fact that they have a left-handed quarterback, and that makes that right tackle much more valuable. It doesn't change the fact that they drafted a right tackle. I don't care if Tua is left-handed and that's technically his blind side. The fact is, it's still a right tackle playing right tackle. it's still a position that you should be able to find a really good right tackle in the fourth round. It's still a position that you can find a really good cheap right tackle in free agency. You know, if you want to say, you know, with the Lions for a little bit, it's not really a pass, but you at least say, well, okay, they drafted a guy who is a pure left tackle. You know, he's someone that everyone projected to be left tackle. It's like when the Raiders signed Trent Brown. Yeah, it's stupid to sign him for $16 million a year. But at least they knew they were bidding against people who were going to be bidding at left tackle salary. So they didn't really have a choice. But the fact is, it's still a right tackle. So I don't see the value in that. You know, moving all those pieces to move up whatever it was they did, four or five slots to get a right tackle, and then try to say, well, they can put garbage at left tackle. This was really what they needed to do. It's not that. You know, if they would have drafted a left tackle like the Lions did, you draft a left tackle and you say, well, he's going to play the right side. And in this case, you say, well, and he's specifically playing the right side because my quarterback is left-handed. I can buy it a little bit. But I can guarantee you, even though you got that left-handed quarterback, when it comes time for that second contract, no matter how awesome the player is, he's still probably going to slot in with the right tackles. Only a handful of guys have broken out of that mold. Really just one. That was Lane Johnson. The Eagles made an exception for many years ago, and I've never quite understood it. They were afraid to lose him. But, that's really been it. Yeah, and then the couple of years the Raiders did the deal with Brown. But that's been it. So that's why I look at that as just kind of a waste, regardless of how he plays. It just has more to do with the availability of talent at that position throughout the draft and throughout free agency versus left tackles, who are really not as available later in the draft. You know, it's first and second round kind of players. They're harder to come by in free agency. They cost you a lot in free agency for kind of poor players. Basically you might pay just as much for a mediocre left tackle in free agency as you would a top right tackle in free agency. So yeah, that's kind of the approach that I would take when it comes to the Dolphins with that. And the other thing people asked a little bit was, you know, what would change if the Jets moved him to right tackle? That doesn't change anything there. Right tackle is valued lesser than guard. So, you know, that wouldn't change it. You know, he'd have to play left tackle. I don't think anyone projected him as a left tackle at the NFL level. Might he be? I don't know. Maybe, I guess it's possible. That would change the evaluation of it if that was the case. It's still not going to come out as a high likelihood of quote unquote winning trade. But there would be more potential in that than spending that on a guard or a right tackle. So I think that was really it. It was just follow-ups from last week. So let's get into the questions here, and let's go through and let's see what I got in emails first. That was a right tackle, left tackle question, which I just handled. Donald asks, what would the contract implications be for both teams be, both short and long term, if the Packers and Texans traded Rodgers and Watson post June 1? Also, do you think the Texans would bite on three firsts from Green Bay if Denver offered them the same in a trade for Aaron Rodgers? Okay, so for Rodgers, let's just look up Rodgers first. So if they did a June 1 cut, they would have 17.2 dead next year. They would take on 21 million dead this year. So over the 2-year period, when you factor in carryover, you're basically breaking even on this year's number. And then you're saving a lot after that. So you basically call this 37 million that he's already got a dead cost. If you're going to trade him, and basically what you're looking at is you're saving 40 million on the cap, I guess on 22 and 29 and 23. We're talking about the way that I guess some of these net things would work out. You know, that would, I guess, be the benefit. Let me just run the numbers and let's make sure that I'm not doing anything crazy like I did with the James stuff before. You'd basically be saving yourself this year 15-2 in cash. He's got some NLTB money that he might not earn anyway. So let's just call that 15-2. Yeah. And then you're going to save yourself 25-5 next year. So, you know, it is over the long haul. You know, that's a big savings. And you don't really, 2023 is not a big deal. You know, so over the long haul, yeah, that's a big savings if you want to do that. In terms of Deshaun Watson, you know, Deshaun Watson would free up. See, he doesn't have a big salary this year, so they only save $10 million this year. I'm assuming he's not attending workouts, so I think his base is going to get knocked down by $500,000 at some point. So you're saving $10 this year. You're deferring $15 to the next year, so you'd be saving $20 on the cap, $19 on the cap. So $19, it's a $29 million extra, I guess, in 2020 overall. Is how that would work out from where they are now, where he'd have a $40 million cap charge. You know, now, if you mean if they traded for those two players, you know, that basically that stuff is all going to offset. So, you know, if you're the Packers, you're taking on $10 million this year from him, and then you're taking on $35 million next year in salary for him, for Watson. And I don't think the Packers want a quarterback. You know, they drafted Love for a reason. So unless they've already, you know, decided he stinks, I don't think they're looking to bring a quarterback back. And in the case of the, you know, the Texans, they'd lose a little bit more cap room this year, and they'd probably gain a little bit next year. So, you know, ultimately, you know, I don't think either team really gains or loses much by doing something like that. Do you think the Texans would bite on three firsts from Green Bay if Denver offered the same in a trade for Rodgers? Yeah, I think the Texans at this point would trade for anybody. I think they would trade Deshaun Watson for three first-round picks. Doesn't matter who it comes from. I think they would. I think they're ready to move on. They just need to figure out what the right price is. Let's see. Not this one. That's something else I got to get to. Let's see. From Ireland, from Jamie, once again. Should a GM be judged retrospectively for his draft picks if the player busts, but conventional wisdom from the football talking heads is that it was a safe pick? If the available tape data indicates that Lawrence is the best QB in the draft, but he turns out to be the worst, is the GM still wrong for picking him? Or is the job of a good GM to interpret, predict better than the man on the street? I would, however, argue that the above is a little outcome rather than process, but shouldn't GMs be judged on outcomes? Yeah. I think they should be. You know, you can judge them on both. So I don't think there's any information that would exist that would make you say, you know, in the example that you're bringing up, that Lawrence is not the right selection in that spot. But I think for most picks, you can probably do that. You know, the thing is, everyone's going to have grades on players. And, you know, you do want to look at them, I think from a couple of different ways. One, yeah, one is the process of it is when you're reaching on a player, what are you doing by reaching? So the Raiders, for example, have reached a lot on players. And I think that's because you've got like a real super draft guy that is sort of running the Raiders front office. I mean, it's Gruden's show, but you got a lot of input coming from Mayock. And I think this is where the pure draft loving guy falls in love with someone and is petrified. You know, that if you don't take someone at 17, that they're not going to be there when you've got another pick, even though everything would tell you that player is going to be there when they have another pick. So, you know, you can judge all those kind of things, all those possibilities. You know, I don't think that you can, I don't think you give too much credit when someone makes some of those picks. You know, it's like Grigson. So Grigson got all this credit originally because he took Andrew Luck. It's like, I could have taken Andrew Luck. You know, there was nothing there that would make you say that was like a good, you know, that was a out of the box pick, that there was anything extra that went into that, that you would go to. But ultimately, yeah, you have to get the overall results, because again, you will never have You will never have a first round, for the most part, where people come out and go, wow, why did they take that guy? There's only a handful of teams where that happens. Everyone usually talks glowingly about those first round picks. You know, and again, I think what it boils down to is we have to assume that most teams have a very similar board. Top pick you probably throw out, and it's just a little different. But I think most teams probably have similar, you know, a lot of similar players there. And ultimately, it's their selection from that list that I think really has to make you go and look at them after the fact and, you know, kind of grade it out. You know, did they do a good job with that pick or not? And you can, I think you can give it a multifaceted grade. You can grade the process of it. You can grade the logic behind it and say, okay, it made sense, you know, why that made sense. But at the same time, when the player doesn't work out, you probably need to question your own process about why did that make sense and why didn't it actually work out on the field? But I think when it comes to general managers, you have to do that with a number of things. I think you have to look at it with free agency. You have to look at it with cap management. You have to look at a lot of different factors in what the general manager does and doesn't do when it comes to these things. But I think ultimately, yeah, it does boil down to results. I think we're talking about a draft that's got five quarterbacks in it. I think the only one that you can't question as a pick at all is probably Lawrence. And, you know, if Lawrence busts, eventually it's going to look bad on the organization, probably more than the general manager himself. But it's something that certainly is going to impact them and would be a lot of what ifs. You know, why didn't they see something more special in Wilson or Lance or whomever? I think those are fair questions. You know, if Trubisky, for example, was consistently considered the top prospect that year, I don't think you can, you know, Chicago, in terms of trading for quarterback, that was a great trade for quarterback they made. They didn't really have to give up that much in terms of what they traded to move up for a QB. Now, did they need to do that trade? You can question that because you knew San Francisco wasn't taking a quarterback. So you can question that aspect of it. But of the pick, you know, you go back and you look to see, well, what did everybody miss that made them think that this guy was better than the other two? I think you have to take into account the end result because, look, everybody is going to be right when it comes to first round picks if you just go based on what is the consensus. It's only going to be a handful of teams that make reaches to the point where people go, huh? Like, what is that? You know, you're taking a running back too. You're taking this defensive end that nobody had ranked top 20 at like number six. You know, those are the handful of picks that stand out, but most other ones don't. So you're judging the results there and you're judging with the impact on a team. Greg said, you mentioned previously that New York Jets free agent contracts this offseason were on the all cash pay as you go side of the spectrum. For a team with good cap health that doesn't need to prorate, what are the downsides of this payment structure? So in general, what you're doing now, maybe for this year, it's not a big deal. But I think in general, when you go to this cash equals cap philosophy, which is the one that, the Buccaneers basically invented and we've seen the Raiders use and other teams use, they don't give you the ability to optimize your roster every year. Because, you see, the benefit of the signing bonus, you know, or using void years and stuff like that, is kind of a buying on credit. When you buy on credit with the right player, or you buy on credit at a level to where it's not really going to hurt you that much in the future, it's okay. Because if I can create an extra $10 million in cap space this year that I can spend on another player, know, if I can bring in a Will Fuller type for $10 million on a 1-year deal by manipulating the cap a little bit more on five players, that's okay. That's not that big of a deal. Not in my mind. Because if you go and you look at the teams where you say, well, the Buccaneers never have dead money. Never. You know, they basically, the only money that could be dead money is rookie contract money. And for the most part, since top picks are guaranteed for years, you're only going to have dead money from the low-level guys. So your dead money is always going to be like $500,000 a year, $600,000 a year. But when you do the all-cash philosophy, what you're essentially doing is burying dead money, because the contract itself doesn't really fundamentally change that much. You know, you're still paying the same annual value, same 3-year value. They're probably getting pretty close to cash payouts that you would give, whether it's a signing bonus or not. So really all you're doing is taking dead money and you're kind of putting it in the current year. You're just saying, well, we don't know when we're going to cut him. We know we're going to have to cut him at some point. So rather than having to cut him and have someone say, oh, I can't believe they signed this bum and he's got $5 million that, you know, left on the cap for the team, or $10 million, you know, the Maccagnan thing, everyone's like, oh, well, they did such a great job with the cap. There's no dead money. It's like you've been paying dead money for the last 2 years, you know, in that deal. And if the players work out, again, you didn't optimize your ability to surround the entire team with talent because you were committing too much cap room. So I think when you build a roster, and this is where you get into to kind of exploiting stuff, all right? You know, when you build something, like if you build a portfolio, right? If you're doing something with your retirement accounts, or you're investing in a mutual fund or whatever it is, you know, you're trying to maximize your rewards by minimizing risk, right? You've got these different outcomes that you can have, these different possibilities. And yeah, it's possible that everything, you know, goes belly up, it's a bust, and, you know, you sink yourself. But I think the theory would be is if you sign enough players, let's say it's enough guys to, you know, 3-4 year contracts or whatever they are. Yeah, some of them are going to fail. Some of them are going to succeed. And if you're lucky enough to get more successes than failures, you can probably optimize your team better in the short term by deferring some of those salary cap dollars to the future when there's a chance they might not be on the team. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's beneficial to use signing bonuses. You know, if you look at the teams that have had like no dead money, there's been no inherent advantage that those teams have had to competing with those teams who have actually had more dead money. If you look at the teams that basically have an average amount of dead money in a given season, which is probably between $10 and $12 million a year, maybe, those teams typically outperform the teams that have like no dead money. And the reason for that is they're taking little risks along the way that help them optimize their team. Help them optimize their roster by maximizing the amount of cap room that they have to spend in a given season. You see, I don't think the league is built for this concept of building the 1-year super team. You know, we're gonna rebuild everything in free agency. That's doomed to failure. Okay. But the league absolutely can support adding little bits and pieces every year. So rather than clearing out all my cap room every 3 years, like the Jets, you know, the Jaguars, to where I can just go on a huge spending spree and sign whoever and do whatever. I would rather look at it this way and say, I want to structure this in a way to where every year I can make sure I'm adding 15, 15, 15, you know, whatever it might be. I want to always have that ability to keep adding good players to my roster in free agency as well as in the draft. I don't want to tie myself down to, well, it's all got to be done this year. And I don't want to tie myself down to the point where I'm like, well, I'm afraid of what the future might hold. You know, there is an optimal contract structure that you can figure out based on the position, based on how long the players are expected to kind of perform, you know, before you think you would cut them, how that works within the parameters of the market, and how you can get that contract out there to minimize what will probably be the dead money in that deal, but at the same time, maximize your opportunities in the current league year and the year thereafter. That's the way that I think I would approach it when it comes to that. So, but I think that's the negative of the cash pay-as-you-go kind of system, is that it doesn't give you the opportunity to improve your roster. You know, it limits your abilities to do that because you're putting yourself up artificially against the salary cap when you don't need to be there. And all you're doing is positioning yourself for a point in the future if the players all flop, which they could, to where you've avoided that massive dead money number. So you've struggled for 2 years probably. And now 3 years down the line, you're just going to say, okay, well, I got all this cap room. I'm just going to, you know, again, I'm going to go into it and I'm going to sign 8 million free agents and I'm going to win March. And then September is going to hit. And I'm going to bang my head against the wall because the team sucks. And now I'm stuck with these guys for 2 years. But on the bright side, I know in 2 years, they're not going to have dead money. So there is a absolute happy medium that comes between the, you know, the craziness that might be the Saints and the Eagles and some of those teams and the ultra conservatism of what the Jets are doing right now or what the, you know, the Buccaneers have done for all these years, until this year. You know, there is a happy medium. And I think that's one of those things that teams should do a little bit more work with in terms of kind of discovering what that happy medium should be and how if you really did all these different projected outcomes, if you do that, I've done a little work with this kind of stuff, but you can put those probabilities on your free agents and you can come up with theoretical numbers for your dead money every year. And I think as long as your theoretical numbers end up under, let's say, $13 million or $15 million if the cap grows significantly, you're fine. And I think you just want to keep it there. You want to be in that sweet spot to where your dead cap is probably projected to be between 9 and, say, 13, 9 and 14. And again, you might have you run a bad luck to where that, you know, 9 to 13 ends up being 30, and you're probably going to get fired. But you've also given yourself way more opportunity to continue to add every year to this team players and not feel like you're only able to add in the draft or you're only able to add through the cheapest parts of free agency. You know, you're just always going to be able to add to your team by touching, you know, by hitting the right numbers and the right buttons on it. Okay, let's take a look at Twitter now. All right. Couple questions here, then we'll wrap it up. Joseph says, what is the value of an NFL roster spot? When the Jets traded up to get AVT, they sacrificed one third round pick and moved down from the third to the fourth. In doing so, they hypothetically open up one roster spot. What is that value? Is it the value of a UDFA, more or less? It's not... I think the way that you would do that... And again, maybe this is different team to team, just based on what their salary cap situation might be. But I think in essence, what you would do is you would be kind of looking dollars saved, dollars lost. You know, when I evaluated the Jamal Adams trade, for example, and we just looked at it as purely as draft picks, I didn't want to look at it that way for Seattle. I had a different kind of approach there. And you could apply the same to the Jets in this too, but one of the things that Seattle did by trading away those first round picks is they did create enough salary cap space to essentially go out there and sign like a mid-level player. So it wasn't as if it was just Jamal Adams for two ones, you know, and whatever player they traded away, the safety. It was more like Jamal Adams and say $10 million to spend. I don't remember the exact number, for two first round picks. So I think you would do the same here. You know, if you went and you looked at that, let's see if I can just find the numbers here. Normally, I would probably actually look in cash more than cap charges. But I mean, you know, if you look just at cash, let's take a look here. So the Jets moved from 23. All right, so let's see. The Jets would have spent 13, 3, 4, 6, 1, 7, 2. And they ended up moving to 14, right? They spent 15,885,074. The Jets got a fourth rounder. Is that the second pick in the fourth round, 107? That's not guaranteed, but I'll just throw it in there. 4287364. So that's their two costs that they got, and they traded two third round picks. I really should just look up the numbers here. I'm just going to guess it's the Vikings picks. I know one is 66, so that's 5223416. And doing it this way is going to overvalue the third rounders a little bit. And is the other one number? It's probably number 90. Okay, let's see. So it was 86. So I probably have the Jets' fourth rounder off here. I gave the Jets' own fourth. What number did they get from Minnesota? Oh, that's right. The Jets traded that down. So it was going to be 143. So let's just put that one in there. 143. That's a comp pick. 3979344. Yeah, I had the wrong one before. I put in their Jets' own fourth pick. So if these contracts are played out, which is highly unlikely, but let's just pretend they were. So basically what you would gain, and this will give you an idea of a roster spot. So the Jets would gain about $3.6 million over 4 years. So that works out to be about $895,000 a year. So I would say that the value of that roster spot, and again, it depends on how you want to use that money, how you want to use that. But over a four-year period, that would basically be the equivalent of like a third-year street free agent. You know, it's a little bit under the veteran minimum. I think it's 990 right now. So 895 a year, if you looked at that, would basically buy you a futures contract from somebody, you know, who's been in the league for 2 years, but has been cut and just happens to be hanging out. So that's how I would actually calculate the value of the roster spot. When you evaluate the trades, is you can throw all those numbers in there, and you can come up with a value of an additional player that maybe could be added to it. Stiso says, is there something about third round picks that make these rookie deals more complex? I believe I saw an article about that previously from you. So basically the third round, the NFL is weird. Everyone decided early on when these deals got done that the first round was basically going to be fully guaranteed through most of the draft, and that the players towards the end of the first round would have, you know, 3 years guaranteed or something like that, and that the second round would have basically first 2 years guaranteed, and all the contracts would get maxed out to the permissible levels of the CBA. But then when we moved on to the third round, there was a lot of negotiating wiggle room in terms of what those salaries would be. Whereas the fourth round, then it was decided everyone would just get the minimum salaries and the standard signing bonus. Why nobody has pushed for more money and more guarantees in rounds 4, 5, 6, 7, no idea. Why things happened the way they did for rounds 1 and 2, don't really know. But round 3 has kind of struggled with that. Right now, it's basically max compensation for, I think it is the first 7 picks in the third round, I think, have been able to get max compensation, maybe 6 picks, 7 picks, something like that. Or if it's not max, it's pretty close to the max. I forget. I did a run on the numbers recently just to see through, but it's like the top couple players. And so every year that grows by like one player. So you just end up with all this negotiating about fourth year salaries and third year salaries. And, you know, most of the time it's probably, you're talking about the difference of maybe hundreds of dollars, not hundreds of thousands, just hundreds of dollars. So it's just been something to where that ends up being the kind of the harder one for the sides to nail down when it comes to the contract. So that's really why. It's just that right from the start, there was no standard, it seemed like, with the third round. Whereas everyone kind of immediately fell into a standardized system with rounds 1 and 2 with a very similar growth every year. It moves by one spot. Everyone fell into the same patterns with 4, 5, 6, 7, but the patterns for round 3 varied greatly to where, you know, pick 13 in the round might end up with a contract that was valued higher than pick 8, just based on the strength of the agent's argument. Jason asks, you misinterpreted my question last week. What if a player signs a big contract then just doesn't play hard? They show up, give minimal effort. What if Deshaun Watson started throwing picks if he wasn't traded before the scandal broke? What can a team do? So, you know, at that point in time, the CBA does have – you do have the ability in there to basically do two things. One, you can eliminate their ability to get termination pay. You basically will give them a warning. You know, it's a written warning that basically says, you know, you're not practicing, you're not doing what you need to do to play football. So just so you know, if this continues, we're going to cut you and we're not going to owe you your salary for the year. So that's one of the things that you can do. The other thing that you would probably be able to do, most teams have an ability to take the guarantees away from a player for conduct detrimental to the team. So if you felt that a player was actually throwing games, you know, was out there throwing tantrums in practice and not, you know, behaving like Brown did with the Raiders, you know, stuff like that, you would be able to suspend them for conduct detrimental. And that suspension would likely trigger the forfeiture clauses. It would trigger the voiding of the guarantees that remain in the entire contract. So you'd be able to get out of the guarantees that way. It would also trigger forfeiture provisions for as long as the player stayed on the sidelines. But you're only allowed to suspend for up to four games. So you wouldn't be able to go, I think, beyond that. But I'm sure there is some recourse when it comes to those things. But basically, you'd be able to avoid the guarantees through conduct. And you'd be able to also avoid termination pay if the player's salary was not guaranteed for that given year. JP says, drafted players are added to the OTC site at the NFL minimum. Why not list these players at their known slotted salaries, perhaps left in italics until the rookie deal is signed? Fans would get a better idea of cap space. A couple things for that. We try to follow the NFL procedures, and the NFL procedure is that you just put them into the minimum. That's how the tender process works with a player. And we try to put it to where the cap space that's shown will be reflective of what a team can do if they still want to sign free agents. So that's one of the reasons. The second thing is that, and right now, I think in looking at it, and someone pointed this out too, so I'm pretty sure it's correct. What we did is in the effective cap space column, if you go to the cap space page, that actually now factors in the cost of the rookies this year. So when you see the Jaguars with their cap space of 39 and effective of 29, I don't know if they've signed anybody yet, but that basically factors in how much money they will lose in cap room for their draft picks. So that's kind of included there. The one problem is that I think now that rookies are signing, it's a double count. So in other words, if a first round pick signs, I think it's still, they're showing up. Cause I think we just pulled the rookie pool out of the effective cap space number. I'll check with Nick on that, and see if that's the case. But before any players were signed, I can tell you that the effective cap space, will give you the number, based on what the contract will be. But that's, we've just tried to do it the way the NFL does it. That's the main reason. Dadpool, when are movies going to come back to the theaters? I don't mind watching them at home, but it doesn't compare to the big screen experience. I would imagine that you will start seeing now that the mandates are going to be lifted. I would imagine, Memorial Day, you'll probably have your slate of blockbusters if you're looking to go to the movies. Black Gold, was exercising Darnold's fifth-year option smarter than letting him play out year four and tag him if he's good? What's the value of having a year to evaluate him? I don't think there's any value in doing that option tag. You locked yourself into 18 on a player who's probably not going to be worth it. He's not much better than Teddy Bridgewater. He's not better than Teddy Bridgewater. And you were disgusted with Teddy Bridgewater after 1 year. So I don't know why you would see that any different. Your transition tag this past year was $23 million. Probably end up being, you know, 24 next year, something like that, 25. I wouldn't mind risking $4 or $5 million in cap space to just watch the kid play and determine if I need to throw on one of those tags, or, you know, if I can sign him for cheaper. I think by locking in at 18 or 19, whatever the salary was, it's just a mistake. And I think there was more value to possibly spending $5 million more than locking yourself into 18. I think that's the way that I would look at it, is that you locked yourself into something when you only had to pay, you know, your insurance, basically your insurance cost you would look at as being like $5 million. So rather than take out a $5 million insurance policy, let me just get Sam's number correct here. Yeah, 18.5. So, or 18.8, sorry. I have his guarantee in there wrong. 18.8. So 18.9. Yeah, so basically your insurance premium on Darnold would have cost you $4 million, $5 million if he hits. And if he hits like tremendously, well, you were going to extend him anyway. So who cares? You know, those numbers are always going to be the same. So basically it was $4 or $5 million extra if he would have been a semi-hit or a hit, than just taking a full risk of 19. So yeah, I think it was a bad decision by Carolina. Pedro says, how have you felt about Washington's offseason? I think they've had a pretty good offseason. I think they've done a good job of adding a little bit on defense, which was already kind of like a decent unit for them. I think they've done a good job of adding on their offensive line. They have a guy who can at least be exciting at quarterback. So, you know, I don't think they were in a position to really grow considerably, but I think they've done the most with what they have. The guard signing, the guard franchise tag makes no sense at all. And some of the things they've done with their contracts worry me, because it's very clear that this is Carolina all over again. But I think in terms of who they added to their team in free agency and the way that they've kind of approached things, I think they've given themselves an opportunity to be competitive again in that division. Even as the division improves, I think they at least have a chance to be respectable, maybe even exciting at times. But I think some of the salary cap stuff would concern me from an outside view of watching it. Packer fan, any insight as to what the Packers can do contractually with Rodgers to make him happy, but also not limit their flexibility, possibly making his deal guaranteed? Also, can I get your autograph? I don't know why anybody would want my autograph. You know, I did have somebody once at the Tulane competition ask me for an autograph. I kind of laughed at that. I thought that was the silliest thing. I didn't even know what to do. I think I was sitting there with Bryce and like having a muffin, and somebody went up and asked for if they could have an autograph. You know, that's actually pretty flattering. But that one caught me off guard when it came to that. Otherwise, I think it's just been relatives that have asked for a autograph book or something. I don't know if there is anything that they could do contractually with them, because I don't think, if you're looking at not limiting your flexibility, I think Aaron Rodgers wants a guarantee for the rest of his contract. I don't think he wants, like, you know, Melvin Ingram last year took a guarantee on the Packers will guarantee him his salary this year and no problem. You know, does he want more incentives in the deal the way that Brady did? Maybe, but I don't think that's his issue. I think his issue is he wants that long-term love, and you can't do that without hampering your flexibility. So I don't think there is really a happy medium here the way there may have been with other ones. Now, maybe if Rodgers looks to save face, yeah, you can throw some added incentives in there that give him the ability to, you know, if he wins MVP again, you know, get an extra couple million, you know, stuff like that. But I don't think you can do anything that really makes him truly happy long term with the team. John says, why does the use of a void year in Eric Fisher's contract suggest there might be an extension? So it was reported that Eric Fisher's deal is going to have a void year, which is very not Indianapolis Colts at all. So, you know, Indianapolis is one of those teams that is much more cash to cap. They don't use a lot of signing bonus stuff. They use a little bit of it, not too much. They had cap room. They do have a couple guys they want to extend. So this will give them the ability to kind of use their traditional structure with them. But I don't think the Packers want, I don't know what the number is, but let's just say it's $4 million sitting there next year. I don't think they want it there dead for a player that's not going to be on the roster. That's not the way that they've managed their roster at all the last 3 years. So I think the fact that they already used that is basically a tell that they wanted to maintain as much cap flexibility for this year as possible. when it comes to this. But the way they envision this is whatever Fisher's real number is going to come out to be, if it's 9 million, it's 9 million. They want this to be a scenario to where in February they can go to him and say, okay, you know, or maybe even before that, maybe in December, if all things are going well, where you go to him and say, hey, look, we want to extend you. And, you know, we want your contract to continue. And I think when I see that there, that tells me that their long-term vision is that they're signing him right now because he's hurt to this contract and that they can't commit to anything longer term, but they want to make a longer commitment. They want him to be their left tackle for the next couple of years. And I think that that's just a sign that that's the thought process. But to get there, you needed to do this intermediate step because of the questions with the injury. You can't commit to that other stuff. So I think that's why. Philip says, is there any chance the Chiefs could find their number two wide receiver before week one? Trade for Julio Jones, Michael Gallup, Neil Harry, or Cornell Powell, or develop the rookie? They're not going to trade for Julio Jones. I mean, I don't even know if Julio Jones would be happy, you know, if that was the situation that he would go into. You know, Kansas City, they've only got like $8 million in cap room, so I don't think they could even afford somebody like that. And, you know, if you look at where they are next year, they have like $7 million effective once they get to 51. They have a lot of contracts coming up. I don't think they're going to be in a position to where they're looking to trade for an expensive player, you know, at all. I don't think the Cowboys are going to look to get rid of Gallup. You know, I think they're just going to develop players. I think that they look at trying to find guys that fit that system, fit what they want to run, and they will find ways to utilize them. I shouldn't even say fit that system. They'll tailor their system to kind of mesh with the talents of the players they have there. But I think they're going to look to develop guys. I don't think that they're going to go the trade route on that side of the football. I really don't. I think they're just going to look for speed. And they're going to look to develop players that might exist, on that team to kind of take over those roles. You know, as a kind of that number two. All right. Let's take a look. A couple more here and then we're done. Dave, how many years do you give Joe Douglas if Zach Wilson is a flop? If Zach Wilson is a flop in 2022, Joe Douglas will be gone by 2023. There's nothing Wilson can do this year. You know, unless he was like Johnny Manziel crazy. And I don't think there's been anything to say that would be the case at all. You know, I think as long as, Wilson is not, you know, doesn't have some kind of off-field thing that we know nothing about. And no, I'm not talking about his mother. You know, if there is something that we know nothing about, you know, if that happens, something could happen this year. But in general, I think he's got 2 years to develop the kid. I think if Wilson does not look like a star after year two, that unless the team around him is able to carry it the way that the Bills were able to carry Josh Allen, my guess is Douglas will be gone. You know, now it's possible that the rest of the team around him maybe will be that good to where you can, you know, carry him the way someone carried a Mark Sanchez. I wouldn't think so, but anything is possible. But I think if the quarterback is a flop, I think the team will probably continue to struggle. And I think after 2 years, that'll be it because you'll have just too many poor years. You'll have two head coaches, too many quarterbacks. So I think it's a 2 year process. Have I looked into Badger yet? It's DeFi. No, I have not looked into any of that. You know, the whole crypto thing is some of the stuff is interesting. You know, I've kind of looked at it for some time, some of the stuff. I don't know how much value there is in some of those things. It's like an interesting thought. I don't know if there's really anything in it. There's probably stuff that's going to last long term from it. I don't know what it'll be. I think some of the stuff, like the Ethereum kind of stuff, I think I think there's different uses for that stuff that really might exist business-wise to where you can build a lot of things on those platforms, on those blockchains or whatever they are, for doing things that's very different than calling it money. And I think you would almost look at that as having technology potential beyond the concept of, you know, a deflationary, whatever you want to call it, you know, a independent money source. I don't know if it'll necessarily be that, but I think I could see wide adoption of some of that stuff in the future to build different things that might turn out to be very valuable, which in turn, I guess, would make the underlying assets of it kind of valuable too. But no, I haven't looked into to that one yet at all. You know, I'm still just learning about you know, some of these other crazy ones that exist. I need to make a coin. I need to make the OTC coin, the over the cap coin or something. Anyone wants to help me with that, let's go ahead. Maybe we'll get rich with it is funny. While some of these are worth a lot of money right now, in general, we talk about these. I don't, but a lot of people talk about these things and the coverage that they get. It's kind of amazing because it's essentially a bunch of penny stocks that are getting that coverage. I couldn't imagine a bunch of penny stocks getting that kind of coverage, like in real terms. No one would ever look at companies like that. So it's kind of interesting when it comes to that stuff. Jesse says, how bad is the Patriots cap situation after this year and the following years? And on how easy is it for them to move on from the contracts they just signed? The contracts they just signed this year were terrible. Patriots are like middle of the league, bottom third of the league in cap space next year. Off the top of my head, I don't think it's going to be easy to move on from some of them. They do have flexibility within their team, but let's see. You know, $10 million dead for Aguilar, $19 million for Henry, $24.5 million for Judon. Yeah, that's in 2022. So, yeah, you're not moving on from these guys until at least 2023. You know, but the advantage that they have is they just spent a lot of money on these players, but they have a cheap quarterback situation. So that's a great equalizer. And, you know, that really helps out. If you're going to spend that money in free agency in what was probably questionable spending on their end, you know, this does give them a lot of opportunities. Kyle Bowler's Burner says, seems like void year contracts are relatively new past few off seasons. Do you think there will be negative consequences down the line or a summer where there's less money to spend because of dead money from void years? They're not new. So void years have been around since the 2000s, at least, maybe even the late 90s. It started with the original rookie deals. The way the rules were written, it was causing acceleration in contracts, which is where teams came up with the modern void conditions about roster status, which is weird that the NFL never took it out of the CBA because the purpose of the void year, the NFL always tried to avoid the void year being used as a way to manipulate the salary cap. So teams found loopholes in it. Usually the NFL would close those loopholes. They left these wide open. So they've been around for a while. Some teams have used them more than others through the years. They're just – I think this is the first year that you're seeing widespread use of them just because of the salary cap downfall this year, downturn. But in general, yeah, there's negatives down the line. You know, I can't think of any team that's used these – significantly and has been able to, you know, avoid kind of disasters. You know, the former Redskins, had some disasters. The Cowboys got into all kinds of cap troubles. The Eagles right now are in cap trouble. The Saints went through a three-year period of terribleness with their cap and are probably about to go on to another period of terribleness with their cap. So I think for teams, that'll be the case. I think for the teams, you know, a lot of teams did it not crazy with them. So I don't think it'll lead to a year where you have a whole offseason where teams can't spend money. But you will see individual teams that I do think get burned by it. All right. Last question. Josh says, wide receiver or edge, what's more valuable? Valuable in what way? To the game of football? So I guess it depends on how you define value. And I guess there's a lot of different ways to define it. You know, if you're looking for a premier talent, Gosh, you know, they're actually pretty similar. You don't see – so neither position is available in free agency if you're looking for high-end talent, you know, which makes them very much draft, you know, important, I guess, to capitalize on in your draft. You know, so if you look at, for example, the top contracts in free agency – let's see how many players have switched teams. So one, two, three, four, five. Of the top five, none are a team switcher. Cooper came via trade but didn't switch teams. Golladay switched teams. Beckham was trade. Tyreek Hill. Allen Robinson, he's still on the same team, but he did – that was beyond that. Lockett, Evans, Woods was a switch. Thielen, Cooks has bounced around by trades. Godwin, Kupp. Landry was a free agent signing. It's very few. There's a handful. But then as you get down to the second tier, it's all free agents. So, you know, your second wide receivers are that way. On defense, your edge position is extension, 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 franchise, franchise, franchise. Trey Flowers would be your first team switch. Cameron Jordan, Armstead, Barrett. Za'Darius Smith would be your next one. Chandler Jones was a trade. Bud Dupree would be a switch. Leonard Floyd would be a switch. Lawson would be a switch. Those players are fit. So, you know what? I think I would actually say that if you're looking in terms of availability and you're considering value, meaning like draft, I think I would probably give a lean on wide receiver. If you're looking for kind of a top tier guy, I think that there is probably a better chance to get a closer to top tier guy in free agency for pass rushers than there are for, wide receivers. You know, in terms of, you know, financial, I don't even, I probably should ask as to what's the way to categorize it. I mean, if you look at just overall team success, I think teams that spend more on their entire group of wide receivers probably is in a better position than those who focus on the two main pass rushers, or three, if you want to talk about the situational guy that they kind of pay there. You know, I think it's that ability to where, you know, a wide receiver can, in theory, impact pretty much every single play, you know, with the way they play. Your pass rushers don't generate enough pressures, and I think in every down basis, to have that same kind of impact. You know, so I think, you know, I guess that's what I would think with it. You know, wide receivers, you can find more, I think, throughout the entire draft. Edges, I think, are very specific to the top of the draft. But I think overall, in terms of just building a team, I'd probably lean wide receiver over the pass rusher. I just think that they can impact more plays. They're on the field probably more, than, you know, your top pass rushers. You know, a top receiver doesn't really have to come out, you know, even a top flight pass rusher, you probably need a third guy just to spell him for 15% of the plays, you know, 20% of the plays. Whereas your top wide receiver probably is hardly ever coming out. You know, he's probably in there close to 90% of the time, maybe even more, for certain other players. And, you know, you can move stuff around a little bit more there. I also think there's probably more of a tendency for teams to focus too much still on like the individual wide receiver. So I think you can create certain mismatches for other players, more so than teams going with this strategy of you have to play away from the pass rusher the way that maybe teams did in the past. I don't know if we really see that as much, you know, if that's the case. But that's an interesting one. I'd probably have to give that a little bit more thought as to how we define value, you know, and what you can see. There is probably also a bigger disparity, though. You know, if you look at the edge position, there's probably a bigger disparity between your top pass rushers and like a mid-level pass rusher. With wide receivers, there's a handful of really great ones, and I think a lot of guys that'll kind of lump together. So there's probably more of a field of competent players than there are kind of like really competent pass rushers. So maybe there's a little bit more scarcity at the top on the edge position. But yeah, that's kind of interesting. I'd have to give that a little bit more thought as to how we'd want to define the value towards, I guess, winning in the NFL. What is this? That's not a podcast question. And this is the last one. Okay, so I'll do this. If Rodgers were to retire, how would paying back the proration of the signing bonus affect his taxes? So I would guess when it's paid back, you would have that as some type of, I'm not sure if you would have to restate your taxes for that. I'm not a tax expert. Or if you would just have that as, some type of expense in a given year, maybe as a offset on, any salary he would earn from other jobs. I would guess that maybe there's a way you can restate your past taxes in the last couple of years. That would probably account for that. I'm not really sure. There's got to be a tax expert that would know the answers to that. I can tell you how it works on the salary cap, but not anything else. So, all right. I think that is it for me tonight. So that went on for a pretty long time. I have a feeling that there's a lot of me looking up stuff. Nelly, you've been a good little partner here. You haven't made too much noise tonight, so that's been a good thing. So everyone have a great week, and I will talk to you all again soon.